Morning and welcome to the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be speaking to Zafar Bengash, who is known for at Crescent International. Zafar is originally from Pakistan and has traveled throughout the West Asia and has a working journalist for many years, authority on all matters to do with the region. And we want to talk about the issue of, most importantly, of this new agreement, a defense pact struck between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Pakistan. I believe Zafar has joined us. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, good morning, Phil. Yes, I'm with you.
Well, they're very glad to be talking to you. We spoke of you last week because there's this story, and we don't want it to get away because, you know, a week later, sometimes people forget something very significant is going on, which is, I think, most people cannot quite comprehend. And I noticed that Donald Trump is praising this agreement between Turkey, if I pronounce it right, we now have a new spelling,
yes,
and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
I guess a couple of questions are, why is Trump happy about it? And who initiated this and who is unhappy with it? Is it usually when countries get together and say, we're on the same team, there's somebody that not on the team knows that they intend to be attacked?
Well, it's a very good question. You know, what Trump does or doesn't do is really incredibly, it's like a pantomime.
Yes.
You know, he would say one thing now, and a few hours later, he will say something completely contradictory, and he will even refuse to acknowledge that he had said something different a few hours ago.
Yeah. So, yes, I probably shouldn't have mentioned him. He's the X factor.
No, that's okay. But, I mean, it's an important question. I look at it this way. Number one, this so-called military or defense agreement, as they call it, has both a positive aspect as well as a negative aspect. The positive aspect is that the Saudis have come to realize that the billions or, in fact, trillions of dollars that they have paid to the U.S. over the years and built these military bases in their country, as well as other regimes in West Asia, whether it is Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, Jordan, etc., that these military bases and the vast amount of military equipment that the U.S. Had stored there did not defend these countries when the time came. So the Saudis have realized that they have to look elsewhere. Now, the negative aspect of this is that, you know, the Saudis and the Pakistanis and the Turks have to realize that if they make a military pact that is going to target the Yemenis and Iran, then that is going to be extremely problematic. In fact, what would be best for the Saudis is to change their policies. Mm-hmm. They can't change the geography. They can't move their border from Yemen's border. They can't wish away Iran. It exists there. It's a reality, and it's a very, very significant reality. And it has demonstrated its ability to confront the two most evil regimes in the contemporary era. And withstood its ground and really defeated these two powers despite the vast difference in their military capacity. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you look at the total U.S. and Israeli military budgets, they come to something like $1.5 trillion. And when you look at Iran's annual military budget, it's only $7.5 billion. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, Iran has been under sanctions for 47 years. Its assets abroad have been frozen. It is prevented from selling its oil and so on. And you see that despite all of these challenges, that the Iranians were able to not only defend themselves, but also inflict massive damage on these military bases that the Americans had established as a ring of fire around Iran.
This is the first time in history, really, this has happened.
Yes, exactly.
In modern history, that nobody's been able to do this.
Exactly.
Or even dared to.
Exactly. Nobody ever dared to challenge America. I mean, you know, in the past, what was happening was that if an American aircraft carrier, or it was announced in the U.S. that an American aircraft carrier has set sail from its home base, whether it's in Norfolk, Virginia, or wherever, that, and it's going to go against this such and such a country or government because they are not sufficiently deferential to American policies, that government over there would be overthrown by its own country's military. We saw this happen in Pakistan only 4 years ago, mm-hmm. when a third-ranking American State Department official by the name of Donald Liu met the Pakistani ambassador in Washington, D.C., and he told him quite bluntly, he said that if you remove Imran Khan from power, then all will be forgiven and, you know, we would deal with Pakistan in a friendly manner. If not, then you're going to face a lot of difficulties. And this happened on March the 7th of 2022. And 6 weeks later, the military in Pakistan overthrew Imran Khan's democratically elected government. And today, Imran Khan languishes in prison since August of 5th, 2023, under ludicrous charges. I mean, totally nobody believes the allegations that are made against Imran Khan to be true. So you see that in the past, American threats were sufficient to bring a government into line if it was trying to act too independently. Iran has demonstrated that this need not be the case, provided the people are determined, the people are united, and they have a clear goal and a direction, and they are prepared to make sacrifices for it.
Yeah, and so by the way, isn't it striking that that the U.S. and its partner Israel always agree? Their strategy is so barbaric. They assassinate leaders, and they seem to think that, okay, we convinced the Pakistani military to overthrow Khan, and now we're in charge. They think they can murder the leader of Iran, and then they can take charge.
Yes, exactly.
They're daydreaming.
If you consider the statements that Trump made on March the 2nd, which was 3 days after that attack on Iran, in which Iran's supreme leader and several of his family members and top commanders were assassinated, Trump said, I want unconditional surrender. These were his words. Yeah. That I want unconditional surrender. Iranian commanders must come out. They must put their hands up and, you know, and vow never to resist America. And we are going to take over their oil and they must give up their nuclear weapons. Despite the fact that in June of 2025, when America and Israel had bombed Iran's nuclear facilities, Trump had claimed that we have obliterated, that was the word that he used, that we have obliterated their nuclear, yes, you know, facilities. So if you have obliterated them, then why are you calling for them to not have nuclear weapons? They don't want nuclear weapons. They just want to continue with a civilian nuclear program, which is their right under the, yes, NPT. Iran is a signatory to the NPT, which is the non-nuclear proliferation treaty. and it guarantees them the right to enrich uranium for civilian purposes.
And they play by the rules. They have they've had interaction. The issue of what they are their program is and the materials, etc. They shared that with the international agency.
Exactly.
And still got treated like a bandit.
Yes, you see, when you consider these facts, Iran is the only country in the world that agreed to very intrusive inspections of its nuclear facilities under the what is referred to as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that was signed in July of 2015 in Vienna, and then it came into effect in July of 2016. And there is a UN Security Council Resolution 2231 that actually ratified that agreement. And under that agreement, Iran agreed to limit its uranium enrichment to 3.67%. And whatever it enriched uranium above that, it had it shipped out to Russia. And it allowed for intrusive inspections. And let me elaborate what that means. The International Atomic Energy Agency installed cameras all around Iran's nuclear facilities inside. So it was monitoring those activities in real time. Secondly, the international agency's inspectors could at any time, and they were based in Iran, they could at any time go to any nuclear facility unannounced and say that we want to inspect this facility. And Iran agreed to that.
Amazing.
In return, America was supposed to lift sanctions on Iran. Iran was supposed to get its frozen assets back. And, you know, it was supposed to be able to trade with other countries unhindered. But the Americans didn't honor that agreement. In fact, as soon as the agreement was signed, Iran approached a number of European countries that now that we have signed this, you are signatories to this, Germany, Britain, France, they were signatories, and the European Union, they were signatories to the JCPOA, but they didn't do anything about, honoring that agreement. Even when Trump tore that agreement up in May of 2018, Iran did not, go back on its commitments. It waited for an entire year, pleading with the Europeans to honor their commitments, which says that if any party violates this agreement, the others must come to the help of the aggrieved party. Mm-hmm. This is under Article 36 of the JCPOA. And, these European countries just shrugged their shoulders. They didn't do anything.
This is the referee that is actually cheating.
Yes.
Pretending.
Exactly.
They are as bad for betraying and double-crossing the rest of the world as the U.S. It's almost like a tag team.
Correct. And so after waiting for an entire year and the Europeans doing nothing, Iran's assets remaining frozen, and instead Trump imposed even additional sanctions on Iran, on its banks, on its various entities, etc. So Iran said, okay, if you violate the terms of that agreement, then we are no longer bound by the terms of this agreement because you're not fulfilling your part of the agreement. It cannot be a one-way street that you insist on us fulfilling our part of the agreement, but you violate it with impunity. So Iran said, okay, no more inspections. These inspectors were still in Tehran, but they said, you cannot just go unannounced. We are going to start putting our conditions. And they started enriching uranium to a higher degree, up to enriched uranium up to about 60%, which is still far short of making a nuclear weapon. But they basically wanted to use that as leverage against forcing at least the Europeans into complying with their commitment under the JCPOA, but they didn't. So we are now at a situation where obviously, Trump thought that he could, first in January of 2020, he ordered the assassination of one of Iran's top generals, General Qasem Soleimani, who was on a diplomatic mission.
Openly boasted of doing it.
Yes, he was going to Baghdad to deliver a message from the government of Iran. This message was to be communicated to the Saudis, because at that time the Saudis and the Iranians did not have diplomatic relations. and mediation was taking place through the Iraqis, and so this message was to be delivered. And Trump ordered his assassination as he arrived in Baghdad. And he, as you mentioned, Trump openly boasted that we, you know, got rid of him. He didn't stop there. Then in June of 2025, the Israelis and the Americans again attacked Iran while Iran was negotiating with the U.S. through the Omanis. The Omanis were mediating those negotiations. And in the middle of negotiations, the Americans attacked Iran. And again, they killed a number of Iranian generals. The second time, again, negotiations were taking place in Geneva. And again, the Americans and the Israelis struck Iran on February 28. Now, the Americans and the Israelis assumed that if they were to eliminate the top political leadership of Iran and the top military commanders, that...
Whoop. We seem to have lost our Zafar. We'll see if we can get him back. And when we do, we, by the way, Zafar's time is limited today because he has meetings, and we'll try to make sure we respect his time needs. I'm going to ask Zafar, by the way, about this the issue of Yemen, getting it clear. I don't think we speak of it sufficiently or timely enough that Yemen has two claimants on the who is the leader. It's an existing issue that we don't talk about. To my knowledge, there is a state that is recognized by some. Zafar, we have you back. We're sorry about that. We hope you're okay.
No bomb has been dropped here yet.
Yeah. Can I ask you quickly about some matter of Yemen, which you were referring to? There is this issue of who represents Yemen. There is some countries recognize and you can tell me who it is, as a state. And does that play into this? Because we have the people called the Houthis, yes, and we say Yemen, but there are two claimants. Can you clarify that?
Yes, of course. It's a very good question, and I think it needs clarification. You see, so there is a group of people in the south of Yemen that is referred to as you'll constantly read this in the newspapers and hear it on television, etc. The internationally recognized government. Mm-hmm. What that means is that it's a Saudi puppet regime that has been installed in southern Yemen, and it controls a tiny part of the country. Whereas, as you mentioned, the Houthis, or they refer to themselves as Ansarullah, that's their designation. They basically, you know, it means it's a Islamic term, which means people that fight for the sake of Islam and for their dignity and honor. Of course, the tribe is called Houthis. Mm-hmm. They control the north and western part of Yemen, and so they are the dominant force, and they control the capital city Sana'a, which is in the middle of the country, and the northern part, of course, you know, when one looks at the map, they have a border with Saudi Arabia. Mm. Now, the Saudis control certain parts of Yemen, which is obviously northern Yemen, and it's today southern Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis wanted to have the whole of Yemen under the control of their puppets. Now, the interesting part of it is that these puppets don't reside in Yemen. They are hiding in Saudi Arabia, and they call themselves the government of Yemen, yes, the internationally recognized government. For God's sake, if you're an internationally recognized government, you should be in Yemen and should be looking after the people of Yemen. And there's a third factor, which is called the Southern Transitional Government, which is backed by the Emiratis. Now, the Emiratis have constantly played a dirty role, not only in Yemen, but in the entire region. They are very, very tight with the Israelis, and they think that the Israelis are going to protect them.
Three groups.
Absolutely. You know, they're just ridiculous. It's a tiny, tiny, you know, country. It's in shambles now because they took on you know, Iran, and they wanted to, they thought that the U.S. and Israel will wipe out Iran and then we will be the dominant power. Mm-hmm. The Emiratis are even taking on the Saudis. So in other words, they are playing a very, very dirty role over there. So to come back to Yemen, basically the Ansarullah are in control of much of Yemeni territory. They are very determined fighters. They do not give up easily, and they've actually never given up their struggle for freedom.
They seem to be very capable of using very advanced weapons, and they seem to be dominant. You know, they have everybody terrified in the Red Sea.
Yes, absolutely. You know, back when Trump's first term, he was trying to act tough with the Ansarullah, and they, you know, really taught the Americans a lesson. And then later on, until about 2021 and 22, American naval fleets in the Mediterranean that were prowling that region, the Ansarullah fired some missiles and drones at them, and the Americans fled. They actually made a deal with the Ansarullah that, okay, we are going to have a, you know, ceasefire between us, so you don't attack us and we won't attack you. But the Ansarullah actually control the passage through the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. There is a very narrow passage that's referred to as the Bab al-Mandab.
Yes.
Bab, of course, means door, and Mandab is the name of the place. So it's the door of Mandab through which vessels, tankers, and others passed coming south in the Red Sea. Now, the Saudis thought that they're going to, since the Strait of Hormuz is closed,
take over the gate.
They're going to send their ships through the Bab al-Mandab, and the Yemenis or the Ansarullah will not be able to do anything. And they even bombed Sana'a airport, and the Ansarullah said, okay, you bomb our airport, we're going to bomb your airport. And they have even struck, the Saudis refining, the largest refinery they have, mm-hmm. in the south of the country, in a place called Jizan. Mm-hmm. So the Ansarullah struck that. They even struck a number of Saudi oil tankers and forced them to turn back to go to Yanbu, which is the main oil terminal of Saudi Arabia at the top of the Red Sea, at the northern end of the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. So the Saudis, while they were hoping that they'd be able to ship their oil through the Bab al-Mandab, have been frustrated by the Yemenis.
Yeah. And there's an echo here of the previous agreement. Years back, and we had you on the show talking about this, the British helped the Saudis when they were bombing Yemen. And I recall, and we spoke to you about it, they tried to enlist Pakistan and Egypt, and both of them ended up retreating from that. Is that right?
Yes. In March of 2015, when the Saudis announced that they are going to attack Yemen because the Ansarullah have taken over in Yemen, in Sana'a, and their puppet, who was at that time sitting in Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis had killed the previous president, Ali Abdullah Saleh. They bombed his house in 2012 and they killed him. And so then they, installed another puppet, Hadi Abdul Rabbu, and he was hiding in Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis decided, together with the Emiratis, with the Americans, with the French and the British, of course, the French, British and Americans were providing intelligence and weapons, etc. Mm-hmm. But the Saudis and the Emiratis were doing the bombing campaign. They even actually recruited mercenaries from Africa and South America to fight the war against the Ansarullah.
Yes, Colombians.
Exactly. Can you imagine?
We have to remember all those things. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And anyway, so, you know, the Saudis, of course, naturally then turned to Pakistan and to Egypt. Now, the Egyptians had a bitter experience back in 1962 because they were involved in the Yemen conflict at that time, and they got a bloody nose, and the Egyptians said, no thanks, we are not going to get involved again. The Pakistanis, actually, it was Imran Khan who prevented, and at that time he was not the prime minister of Pakistan. He was just a member of parliament, but he presented a motion in parliament and he said, this is a trap. We should not get involved in it. We should not be fighting other people's wars. It is unbecoming of us. We are a Muslim country. We should be trying to make peace between them. And he was able to force this issue in parliament and convince the parliament that Pakistan should not get involved in this war. So that is when, in 2015, it was Imran Khan who saved Pakistan from getting into a quagmire in Yemen.
Now we're seeing an agreement that might lead to a quagmire.
Exactly. Because now there, Imran Khan
that is a very important detail about the career of Imran Khan and America's fear of him.
He has always said, he said, look, we as a Muslim country should not be getting involved in fighting other people's wars. We should be making peace. And that's how we are going to make progress. We are not going to sort of, you know, whether it's in America's interest or in Saudi's interest, we shouldn't be, you know, guns for hire. We shouldn't be acting as mercenaries. But regressively, the Pakistan army is a mercenary army. Mm. It acts as an occupation force in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. The generals have made billions of dollars. I mean, you know, when you look at the list, every army chief, once he retires, he leaves the country and goes to settle abroad, whether it's America or Australia or Belgium or, you know, there are, if you dig up this thing, I think it might be an interesting, you know, story to
somebody ought to do the political economy of being a general.
Exactly. And there are actually hundreds, if not thousands, of retired Pakistani military officers living in Canada. Mm-hmm. And they are millionaires. I've lived in Canada for more than 50 years, and all I can afford is one house. And these people have bought apartment buildings in Mississauga and in, you know, Midhurst. And
they remain generals.
Yeah.
Members of a gang.
Exactly. You wonder, where on earth did they get this money from? I mean, a Pakistani general's salary is no more than about $1,000 a year. So how could they buy millions of dollars worth of properties all over the world?
Yes.
So they are so corrupt, but what they do is they sell their souls. their families have all obtained foreign nationalities, Canadian, American, Australian.
How to buy a country, purchase the generals.
Absolutely.
Zafar, I know that you're going to have to go soon, but I wonder if I could ask you a very esoteric question that rests on my mind. Azerbaijan and Turkey are very happy with that they have an agreement across the northern border for about 40 kilometers of Iran. It's an Armenian territory. It's called the Trump Corridor. What is that about? And is it going to go anywhere, or is that going to just disappear in smoke?
Well, very quick. No, it won't go anywhere because, you know, Iran is aware of what is taking place. The sad part is that Azerbaijan is not only very close with Turkey, but also with Israel. And Azerbaijan is supplying oil to Israel through Turkey. So that's the dirty game that is being played over there. But Azerbaijan knows that if it acts too tough or too big, then Iran is able to deal with it quite effectively.
But Iran has a border with Armenia. They don't want anybody, Azerbaijan or anybody else, to use that, turn it into their border.
Correct. You see,
that's a nightmare.
It is. It's a complicated situation. Of course, you know, they have what you call the Caspian Sea over there, in which the Ukrainians also are trying to get involved. An Iranian tanker was hit over there because Iran uses the Caspian Sea to trade with Russia via the sea route. So, you know, there are a number of issues that are involved over there. But Iran has served notice to Azerbaijan that if it acts against Iran's interest, then it's going to pay a price.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you addressed that. You have encyclopedic knowledge. Zafar Benkash, we're so grateful. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, and it is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm not kidding. Zafar's grasp is encyclopedic. You can't throw him a pitch that he can't hit. Even if it's off the plate, he can get a double off it. This, as I said, is Taylor Port. We're going to take a musical break, and we'll be back, thanks to Pedro.